So very good afternoon to all of you. We will perhaps take about 50 minutes and take a 10-minute break after 50 minutes, and then perhaps continue after that and try to finish off a little after 6. So today, I'm delighted to see some of you from last time and also some new friends who were unfortunately not able to be here last time. So this is like the third and the fourth seminar in this series, and I should begin by giving you a summary of what we talked about last time. The last time was mostly formalism, and I don't intend to inflict that on you one more time, but I want to give you some main points that we made last time, and then go and see how these compare with either other theories or with experiments. In a way, this is a new approach to a very old problem, so it makes sense to compare how we are doing relative to the other current ideas established in other ways. So the starting point of most traditional theories of strong correlations is to try to compute the propagator through the standard Dyson form. And what we saw last time was a very elaborate set of reasoning based on initially on Schwinger's approach to field theory. And then we also discussed how the Dyson-Maliev transformation for spins in terms of bosons has a parallel in strong correlations. So there is an exact reformulation of the TJ model and the operators that we come across in the TJ model in terms of canonical fermions in a way which resembles the Dyson-Maliev transformation. At the end of the day, this analogy is physically useful to figure out what's going on behind rather intense mathematical tricks based on the Schwinger thing. So really we worked with the Schwinger technology, but finally want to express things in terms of this Dyson-Maliev representation. So here, the keystone of this is one writes the propagator in Matsubara frequencies as the product of two pieces. One is an auxiliary Green's function, which looks exactly like the propagator of a Fermi liquid. And then there is a function of frequency which sits on top in the numerator. And if you like, you can pull them apart and write it as a product like this. So this psi goes to zero at very high frequencies, so that the coefficient of g at very high frequencies is not 1 over omega, but rather 1 minus n by 2 over omega. So this already tells you that we are describing here not the full electron, but only a piece of the electron. And this is the piece of the electron which lives in the lower Hubbard band. So the idea is that all the strong correlations are happening in the lower Hubbard band. Most of the probes are looking at the lower Hubbard band. So we need a theory which basically throws out the upper Hubbard band right away at the word go. This is very much in the spirit of what Anderson has always advocated, that the TJ model is a good place to start if you want to understand the low energy physics of the problem. Of course, we had very great difficulties in implementing the Anderson vision, but here is an effort which seems to give some concrete results which are of interest. So the name auxiliary Green's function is given to this little g, and this guy mu is called the caparison factor. The word caparison means a further decoration factor. And mu is not to be confused with the chemical potential. The chemical potential is also mu, but with a bold letter. So this is the chemical potential screams with bold, and this caparison factor whispers with I omega. So how do we calculate this propagator? It requires a pair of objects called psi and phi, which I call as a pair of self-energies. There are two self-energies which determine G, and how do we calculate these in a reliable, in a controlled way? That's the question. Well, there are three possible methods to calculate this. One is an expansion in the parameter lambda, which I have not displayed here, but it's analogous to large spin in the spin wave theory of Dyson-Maliev in the Bose problem. So there is an analogous parameter called lambda, which lives between 0 and 1. And you can do a perturbation theory in terms of lambda, and that gives us a self-consistent skeleton graph expansion, which can be numerically implemented to any order that you wish. We have done to fairly low orders at the moment, but already we get some very useful insights into that. And the formulas for the self-energies, both of these guys look like bubble graphs in Fermi liquid theory, but with strange interaction coefficients, okay, which are not frequency dependent. There are some strange functions of position and space. They're ultimately T and J, as they must be. And a self-consistent argument suggests that these would lead to a Fermi liquid type of behavior for both psi and phi. Of course, when combined together to give you interacting Green's function G, it can give you strong corrections to Fermi liquids. And that's really what happens. The other thing we could do is we could take a phenomenological model for psi and phi based upon a Fermi liquid hypothesis. In other words, once you have this hypothesis, you roughly know what these guys look like. You can make a bold jump and say, at least phenomenologically, we can take a hypothesis about these psi and phi and see what you get from that. And that turns out to be very useful for understanding experiments already. And the third thing is, as I mentioned last time, we had this delightful situation where we were able to compare this extreme correlation theory with an existing very powerful method of DMFT developed by Antoine and company and Gabi Kotliar, largely in a numerical framework, a powerful numerical approach to the many-body problem, and we can shake hands with that. And this shaking hands was made possible by a low-frequency expansion of k and omega of these objects. And I will indeed discuss a little more about this comparison later on today. So the psi and phi look roughly like bubble graphs, in some parameter, in some interaction, which is T and J. The only difference is psi, which is a dimensionless number compared to phi, which is an energy, has one interaction replaced by a dummy. In other words, just one. So you draw all the Feynman diagrams that you wish, and one of the top lines, instead of writing an interaction, just write one. Conserve energy, momentum, do everything as you would in a normal theory, but write one. And that, of course, makes psi dimensionally less of an energy than phi is. It's one energy shy. And indeed, at the end of the day, it's beautiful that the ratio of psi and phi at low frequencies ends up defining an emergent energy scale in the problem, which determines the asymmetry of the Green's function. So it turns out to play a very profound role at the end of the day. But its origin is in this humble engineering dimensional analysis. It really starts with something like this, ends up becoming something much more interesting. So the expressions for psi and phi, at least the lowest order in lambda, involve three Green's functions which look exactly like this, 1, 2, and 3. And you have the same combination of g's here for phi as for psi. And the coefficients are different. They are, in one case, there's a single energy. The other case, there is a pair of energies. And e's are some combinations of t and j. So let me start with a phenomenological way of understanding these spectral functions. So this lambda expansion is a systematic method, and I will not be able to show you simple formulas. It gives you some really beautiful results, but they're all numerical, and we will come to them later on. But I want to start by giving you some ideas about what you should expect to see as novel spectral functions. So the first one that came to mind is this phenomenological thing, which is called the simplified ECFL. And here, just from dimensional analysis, you say that psi and phi are related by some energy. And you say this is true at all omega. And if you make this apparently engineering assumption, the theory is defined, because phi, assumed to be a Fermi liquid, is determined completely by a positive definite spectral function gamma, which is the spectral weight of the self-energy, if you like. And this is chosen to be like a Gaussian multiplied by a quadratic term which comes from Fermi liquid corrections. And indeed, this model gamma determines phi completely. And in turn, gamma is determined by two parameters. little omega naught, which tells you the scale of this Fermi liquid term, and big omega, which tells you the scale at which this rolls off at high frequencies. And you need its Hilbert transform, which you can compute as analytically because it's a simple function. Some error functions show up here. So it's very convenient. It's very realistic as well. In fact, you look at a lot of the numerical work on Hubbert models, the self-energies actually look a lot like a Gaussian. Basically, falls off and then has a little dip in the middle. And if I go and compute the Fermi liquid spectral function, so forget about the thing at the top and just take this gamma and work out the Fermi liquid spectral function, I would get something very simple, a Lorentzian, which will give me very symmetric spectral functions as you would expect with the width that grows as t squared. And this is nothing but standard Fermi liquid. And all the difference happens because you have the second self energy which is sitting at the top. So that gives you at the end a very nice modification of the spectral function. You get basically the same old Lorentzian in k and omega, but multiplied by this extra function, which is a function of omega and k. So this k hat is the momentum measured relative to the Fermi surface. So k hat being 0 means you're at the Fermi surface. And I'm looking at the radial evolution. So in other words, at the Fermi surface, I draw a normal to the Fermi surface, and k hat tells me how far I am from the Fermi surface. And Vf is some bare Fermi velocity, and c is some known coefficient. So this guy is a remarkably light description of the TJ model. It has only three parameters. C is some known number, like 2/3 or something, and delta is computed from a sum rule. In other words, given this little omega 0 and omega 0, delta can be computed because both these spectral functions satisfy the same number sum rule. Okay, so in other words, there is no third parameter delta, independent parameter is determined by these two guys. And it turns out to be a small number, a very interesting small number, which I will argue is experimentally relevant. You'll see that very soon in experiments. So there are these three parameters, delta is computed, C is given. So these two guys, omega 0 and big omega 0, are given by, so these are the two parameters. And eta is basically elastic scattering parameter, which you need to add to gamma in order to describe better the distinction between laser ARPES and synchrotron ARPES. And we'll come back to this origin of this eta a little later, but think of it as something representing impurity scattering. And the claim is that laser ARPES sees less of impurities than synchrotron does, for reasons which are very well known in the ARPES community. So the other thing you could do is expand these two self-energies, sigma and phi, in powers of k and omega. And here, this script r is this Fermi liquid function, omega squared plus t squared. And this can be combined together to give you a spectral function, which is also very, very lean. It has only 5 parameters. Okay? So these 5 parameters are basically summarized as follows. This comparison factor has a velocity nu 0. The denominator has another velocity nu phi. So those are the two velocities. And z naught is the spectral, is a residue here. It's a quasi-particle weight, if you like. And delta 0 is this emergent energy scale that I mentioned before. And omega phi is the curvature of the Fermi liquid part. Okay. So this is another possible description of the spectral function. This differs from the previous one in that this has got a few more parameters, and this is geared to understand the low frequency behavior. The previous one was, in a way, a starting guess. And you will also see that fortune favors the brave. It also turns out to be a very lucky guess. It turns out to actually be an incredibly good global description, satisfies all the sum rules, and explains a lot of the data to an extent which really surprised me. I mean, I was stunned to see how well it was doing. Okay, so a few comments before we begin. These spectral functions are non-Lorentzian due to the multiplying factor that depends upon k and omega. And as a result of this factor which multiplies a Lorentzian, when we compute the maxima of the spectral function, we get different results depending on how exactly we do that. So if we can fix k and scan omega, this is called the EDCs, the energy distribution curves. This gives us one set of spectra that you can define. The other thing you can do is fix omega and scan k. This is called the momentum distribution curves. And these two curves differ at very low energies in the spectral function. And here the distinction is due to this multiplying factor of mu, the so-called caparison factor. This story has a very interesting parallel in the world of neutron scattering. There is the notorious case of spin waves in iron above TC going back to late 70s and early 80s, where people struggled over whether iron above TC is dramatically different from what you would expect, whether it has propagating spin waves far above TC. And it turned out that no, the answer was not that at all. It was much more standard, and the mistake, if you wish, was that people were drawing constant energy scans, fixed energy scan k. You were getting a bunch of peaks which were being mistakenly taken to be magnons. And in fact, it turns out that conservation of the spin forces a maximum and so forth. It's a long story in which I was involved actually at that point, so it comes to mind. So this has some parallel with what we're talking about here. And just to get you going about what these things are, I would say looking at the spectral function of k and omega as a function of k here and omega here gives you some clue to what's going on here. So in constant k scans, which is the EDCs, you fix k and you scan the function this way and look at the peaks. And actually you find sometimes you even get S-like curves. These things sort of bend back because this ridge here extends beyond where this ridge ends. So this is from a real calculation. This is a spectral function that you can calculate from ECFL or DMFT. They both have, in fact, very similar spectral functions. And they're characterized by one ridge which sort of fades away and then another picks up. So this is going to give you the constant k scans. And you could do things the other way with constant omega and scan k. And this always gives you like a unique curve. It gives you a jump at some point. It's called the waterfall effect. And this is a phenomenon which comes about because looked at in the k space with a fixed omega, this turns out to be much more unique. So the MDC and the EDC spectra differ on a coarse scale because of the existence of a ridge. But I'm going to argue later that at low frequencies near the Fermi surface, there's a much more subtle distinction between EDCs and MDCs. And that's called the low energy kink phenomenon. And I will talk about that a little later. So in this talk, I'm going to do a couple of things. I'm going to benchmark this newly developed theory versus various better established theoretical tools. And I'm actually going to begin with a short summary of the second order lambda squared expansion. I have no formulas to show you, but I have nice pictures to show you. Then I'll compare with the high temperature expansion results. The high temperature expansion necessary for this problem did not exist in literature. So we, in fact, had to take Metzner's series and really work it out to eighth order. It was sort of a massive exercise in itself, requiring a couple of postdocs. And we were fortunate to have very talented people who could do that. Some are in the audience. And then I'll talk about comparison with DMFT, which happened last year, with Antoine and I talking about the need to connect these things. And then I'll talk a little bit about a much more standard problem, the Anderson impurity model, solved by Ken Wilson, Krishnamurthy, and Wilkins, like one of the gold standards in many body physics, that gives you a spectral function that we can compare against. And we'll see that the lowest order ECFL actually does really rather well already in this problem. And then I'll talk about experimental benchmarking and predictions. So firstly, I'll talk about the RPS line shapes within the simplified ECFL model. And then I'll take a few minutes to talk about a very beautiful idea due to Casey and Phil Anderson. Phil wrote an absolutely lovely set of papers a couple of years ago at the ripe young age of 88 or so. So it turns out somehow he smelled out some of the right physics in that paper. I think some of the details I disagree a little bit, but it's a remarkable achievement, even if you don't consider the age. So I'll talk a little bit about that. A few words on the high energy kinks, how the T prime can make a difference. For example, the electron doped versus hole doped superconductors have different kinks, and that can be understood on the basis of this second order theory. And this is really a very rich field. This is how to understand this so-called low energy kinks from the perspective of this extreme correlation theory. And we will talk a little bit about that. And finally, I'll talk about asymmetry in frequency. This is a very urgent task, really, I believe, for the community to recognize that there is a strong particle-hole asymmetry, and we need to find ways of quantifying this. And I have several suggestions about experimental analysis. And then finally, if I have time, I'll talk a little bit about open questions. Feel free to ask questions at some point. I mean, don't have to wait till the end. Okay, so here is the beginning of in the beginning of our work, we were asked by very good friends saying, you have a formalism, can you produce a first principles calculation from this formalism, you know, without borrowing anything from expansions, this, that, and the other, just do a simple little calculation. It turned out to be not so simple, but we managed to do it thanks to Daniel Hansen, who was my graduate student at that point. And we basically, in this famous phase diagram that everybody knows of cuprates, while everybody is crowding around here in the underdoped case starting from here, what we found is that we could start from the overdoped case and ride up here almost all the way to the optimum doping. And including, one can get superconductivity out of this theory. The D-wave superconductivity also emerges from the J term. And this is the ride that I'm going to describe today, the evolution of the spectral functions from very low density of particles out almost up to optimum doping. That is described by the second order theory. We can't really get here. We sort of stop somewhere here with the second order in the lambda expansion. So here are some spectral functions that we obtained from the equations I showed you at different values of k. So this is a 60 by 60 block on which we solve these equations exactly. And at some typical values of k, we show how the spectral functions evolve as a function of k. So here are the occupied states. The unoccupied states also we can calculate. After all, we are not doing the hard work of angle resolved photoemission. Being theorists, we can compute the spectral function at any value of k. So here we see this characteristic peak followed by long tails that hang out. And this is, of course, very characteristic of what you see in strong correlation experiments. And these really come out of a microscopic calculation. In this calculation, the only parameters which go in are the hopping T and the J and the density of particles and the lattice. Everything else is obtained from here, from iterative solutions of the equations. So here is something very interesting that I'd like you to look at, the distinction between the EDCs and the MDCs. I talked about scanning the spectral function, fixing omega and scanning k, MDCs, or keeping k fixed and scanning omega. And these give us different locations of the maximum in the spectral function. So in this color-coded diagram, red means high intensity and blue means low intensity. So basically, pay attention to where it is red. And the momentum runs over the irreducible Brillouin zone, go from 0, 0 to pi, 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 0, and pi, 0 back to 0, 0. So this gives you a full representation of what these functions are doing in k space. So the two curves to pay attention to are the green and the black. The white you can ignore right now, and I'll tell you in a minute what it means. The green is from the energy distribution curves, EDCs. And the black is from the MDCs. So you see that near the Fermi surface, which is somewhere here, these guys are very close to each other. But near the 0-0 point, which is the center of the Brillouin zone, there's an enormous distinction between these curves. And this is the high energy waterfall that I showed you a minute ago. This is because of the ridge in the spectral functions. And this white dotted thing comes from the auxiliary Fermi liquid, which I mentioned to you a minute ago, because in this theory, we can always remove this comparison factor and ask, what would a typical Fermi liquid do in this situation? So the distinction between the white and the green tells you what the comparison factor is doing. In this case, it's doing quite a bit. I mean, you'll see at low frequencies it does even more, but already it makes a big difference. So here, this is an interesting counterpoint to this minimal model. So here there's no T prime, it's just a square lattice with a T. Now, it's also known that electron-doped superconductors have a much bigger waterfall in some regions, and it turns out that if you take the T prime over T ratio as people have been recommending, this naturally has this phenomenon enhanced. Okay, so there's a bigger gap here. Okay, now I want to compare a little bit with high temperature expansions. So this is made possible by some real experts in series expansion, Marcos Rigol and Ehsan Khatami. And Edward is sitting here. He did some remarkable long calculations by hand, which were used to benchmark the computers. Usually we do it the other way, but here we had the advantage of a master calculator, so we could really check a lot of the computer results by hand calculations. And so we computed a famous series due to Walter Metzner. Walter had done this work maybe at the beginning of DMFT or something, maybe early 90s, and these guys had used this in a formal sense to a large extent, and it had given lots of insights. But so here the series is, you keep U to be some finite number and expand in T. And here Wick's theorem is missing. It's a very hard series to compute. And Walter had given a series of rules by which you could compute things. And we actually implemented those rules out to very high orders. And these are really massive computer calculations. And from these calculations, we can compute lots and lots of things. A typical example that I can give you are the moments of various types. So at each k, I can compute a symmetric moment. And this can be compared with the EDC spectrum. And already does very well, as you will see in a minute. So here, the symbols are from ECFL, the extreme correlation, the second order calculation, done out to density of 0.07. And you see that at low energies and near the Fermi surface, the green lines, the green symbols and the lines essentially coincide with each other, and up to here, okay? And things go slightly bad near the X point, which is in the unoccupied states. So out here, the symmetric moment really doesn't quite capture, it's not captured by the ECFL somehow. And this is again in the irreducible Brillouin zone wedge here. So you see that even with this rather high temperature comparison, temperature is rather high here, the ECFL is actually getting quantitatively things right, the closed experiment. What you can do better, and there's some really interesting physical insight that you have here. In a very strong coupling model, the act of adding a particle and taking out a particle at the end is very different from adding a hole and taking out a hole at the end. And there you can define different kinds of moments. So for example, this is called a symmetric positive moment, where you first create a particle and then you take it out. And of course, you commute with H to obtain the first moment. So in summary, what happens is the black is the raw spectral function, and the green guy is what you see in photoemission. Because in photoemission, you see the spectral function multiplied by the Fermi function. But here, this particular moment is obtained by multiplying this out by the unoccupied Fermi function. So this basically filters out the irrelevant tail, which hangs out to the left, and zooms in on where the peaks are. So you expect this to do much better at capturing the quasi-particle energies, and indeed it does so. So here the comparison is rather remarkably satisfying. You see that the green lines and the symbols agree not only here, but even at the X point. So this has been a very interesting exercise for us to confirm that, you know, this set of nonlinear equations that we are solving has something right about them. It's getting the scales right at all k, is roughly getting the bandwidth reductions right. So at high temperatures, things are fairly well behaved. Yeah.
Well, maybe it's out of the subject, but have you you tried in one dimension to see what it gives? Because,
That's a very good question. Actually, I've been talking with Steve White. So Steve computed the spectral function using DMRG. DMRG. And we computed the second order thing. And they look very, they look rather good. But Steve is having lots of problems with converging the DMRG. The DMRG, to get spectral functions for the electron, is not so easy. So it's a very nasty set of numerical problems that he is facing. And hopefully, we can still write a paper at some point. But the preliminary understanding is that in one dimension, obviously, we cannot capture the Luttinger liquid kind of exponents very close to the Fermi surface. But you can say, forget that. There's interesting stuff in the broad picture of the spectral functions and how do they look. And actually, they look very, very similar. And they're very sensitive to T prime. You know, if you put T prime equal to zero, then there is this spin charge separation and things are much more uninteresting in the TJ model. But if you put T prime, things become very rich and there are different signs of T prime to play with. So in all cases that we've looked at, we feel very hopeful that things are going well, you know. But I think the block currently is at the DMRG end.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. For the low energy part, they don't do well. But I think what Benoit probably had in mind was the big picture.
Yeah.
The big picture. Yeah, but it has sensitivity to T prime. And look, yeah. I mean, I think what you're saying will make Daniel very happy because he doesn't have to write the paper if you take your advice. But I think Steve and I would like to see. All right. But with DMFT, the comparison is actually much more rich because we have a really well-developed set of results to compare with. So, before making this comparison, I should talk about some formal preliminaries which are needed, which were provided in this paper with Edward, where we took this extreme correlation Schringer equations and understood what they do in the limit of high dimensions. This is really rather subtle piece of analysis here because Wick's theorem is not available, and I recommend anyone who's fond of this kind of mathematics should look at this paper. It's really nice. And so we show that in high dimensions, there are further relationships. The two self-energy psi and phi can be reduced to two momentum-independent self-energies called psi and chi, and phi has a piece which goes linearly with the energy. So once you plug this in by some elementary algebra, you can recompute the Dyson self-energy from these things. And this guy can be expanded out in powers of lambda, this same lambda parameter that I mentioned. And the coefficients are functions of frequency, which are actually given by taking the local Green's function, namely the k-average Green's function, convoluting it several times. And that gives you basically this I with M1, M2, M3. And everything can be expressed in terms of these closed convolution functions. And you can compute these guys. So once you do that, you can compare the results in high dimensions through the TJ model, ECFL formalism, with the Hubbard model at very large U from DMFT. Of course, in the Hubbard model, we have the advantage that Antoine can solve it not just for infinite u, but also at large but finite u. So there is some very interesting comparison possible by looking at various values of u as well. So this is in fact some of the most beautiful high precision DMFT results I have seen. So these are single site DMFT results, and so this is from the Paris group. So here is the spectral function, and here is the imaginary part of the self energy, which has basically a small omega squared region, which is amplified in the lower picture here. You have a quadratic piece, and so these are known from DMFT. And now you can compare them with what you get from the second order ECFL calculation. So these are on absolute scale, in other words, we take the same bare parameters and do two different calculations with them. And you see that these two pictures correspond to different values of the band energy. So this is at the bottom of the band, so to speak, minus D, and this is at the Fermi surface. So at the Fermi surface, you see a large peak, which is more or less coincident between ECFL and the infinite U DMFT. And U of the order of 4 times D is also provided here. And the second feature, which is not the dominant feature, is the so-called upper Hubbard band, called the lower Hubbard band feature. This has differences between the two theories. And but on the other hand, the bump is also located roughly at the same energy. So I think this is a totally nothing concealed kind of a comparison where we're not scaling anything. And we see that already we get the right scales for where the peaks are. And indeed, the ECFL to second order in lambda is doing reasonably well. And on a more coarse scale, you can look at the spectral function represented by these color intensity plots. And so dark is again no intensity, and red is very high intensity. And here I have played a trick, which I'm going to discuss a little more in the next slide too. We don't take the ECFL functions themselves, but divide by, scale the frequencies by the renormalization factor Z. And do the same thing in DMFT and in ECFL. Actually, if I didn't tell you this last line, you would not know which is which. They really look the same. Okay? So on a coarse scale, ECFL, the DMFT look almost identical, actually. Indeed, there are distinctions which we can pinpoint once you know where to look for them. But on this broad scale, they look very, very similar. So now, I want to do the most delicate test, which is how do things look like at low frequencies? So here is a low frequency comparison at different values of density. So here is density of 0.6, 0.7, 0.8, and even 0.9. Actually, 0.9 is really very close to the Mott insulating limit. And we really didn't believe that ECFL to second order in lambda had any chance of working out here. But when you scale the frequency by the Z factor, you see that all these curves look very, very similar at low frequency. So low frequency physics is captured very well by ECFL. So the order lambda squared version is in many ways closer to the finite U version of DMFT. And this is also consistent with our interpretation of lambda as a partial projection parameter. And the thing to learn is that the shapes of the functions are in very good accord, you see? And this agreement is to unexpectedly high densities. The second order lambda calculation was believed to be good only for up to 0.7 or so. And we kind of were shocked to see how well it does even at these densities. But that's because it seems to get the shapes of functions right. Yeah. This, I believe, is zero temperature. Essentially zero temperature.
So you would, in principle, at this large doping, small doping, be in the super gap phase?
Well, this is infinite dimension, right? Okay. We're really doing the same lattice, namely the beta lattice or whatever. So this is not to be compared with experiments. This is really a comparison between two theories. So both of these theories have are being worked on the same beta lattice. So I would say one thing to watch out for is the feature of particle hole asymmetry. Note that M sigma looks quadratic only down to very, very low frequencies. But as soon as you go away from zero, you see that there is an enhanced M sigma here as compared to this side. So tilting of this curve, you get much more asymmetry in these curves than you would have expected from a standard Fermi liquid theory. And indeed, the fact that M sigma vanishes at zero zero frequencies tells you that you are at zero temperature. At finite temperatures, the whole thing would shift up. So this particle hole symmetry is something that I'll have a lot to say about in a few minutes. So this is a very important feature, and it's captured by both these theories. And I should show very quickly that resistivity, also both these curves are interesting. I mean, the DMFT is a much more reliable calculation of resistivity, which is essentially exact as far as I know. And it shows a lack of saturation, which is a very interesting feature that Antoine and company pointed out. This keeps going to very, very high values without rolling over. And the ECFL actually does very well at low temperatures, but it peels off a little bit from this and also shows a lack of saturation. And the momentum distribution curves are indistinguishable. You would never know which theory you're talking about. They look exactly the same. So this whole comparison is very exciting because we have, on the one hand, a very powerful numerical approach, and we have this other ECFL newbie, which is a new kid on the block, as they say. It has analytical abilities. It has simple formulas which seem to capture interesting aspects. So we really expect to learn much more from facing these two with each other and combining in some way. So I'll just do the Anderson impurity model and then we'll stop at this. So Anderson impurity model is basically, as I said, a single impurity problem. It's got no mysteries about it. Ken Wilson solved it. And yet, if you ask, what does the spectral function look like for the single impurity Anderson model? The answer is not many people know what it looks like. We know roughly what it looks like, and we pushed the experts to tell us what they look like. And they were a bit annoyed in the beginning, but finally gave us the data. So Alex Hewson basically ran his code of NRG to give us the spectral functions. So rho sub g is a spectral function, so the local spectral function. And once again, you see that provided we scale the frequencies by the renormalization factor z, you get curves which are looking really, really similar. In fact, the red is the ECFL because it's much more smooth. The blue is more jagged because the NRG has analytic continuation problems, and it's very difficult to get smooth spectra from NRG. And so that's how I recognize which is which. And this comparison keeps going on till almost, this is like the condo limit, almost n sub d equal to 1 is, of course, the limit of exactly 1 electron per atom, and that would be the condo limit. So as you approach the condo limit, z becomes very, very small, and yet this comparison looks very, very good. I should say the Friedel sum rule is satisfied exactly in this case, just like the Luttinger volume theorem is exactly satisfied in the lattice. And if you look at the various self-energy. So this is the spectral function of the self-energy. So this is like 1 over tau, 1 over the lifetime of the quasi particle. It looks very much like what we saw for the DMFT-ACFL comparison. We have a strong asymmetry, we have a quadratic behavior at very low frequencies, and then these things roll over. And this is what we get from for the two self-energies, we have chi and psi, which go into this calculation. Of course, from the NRG, I suppose it's also possible to find rho of sigma. We didn't get, I think Alex ran out of patience with us, and he did not bother to provide us with rho sigma, but maybe it can be done as well. And I think it's interesting that this looks so much like the lattice DMFT solution. So maybe this is a good point at which we can pause, take a few questions, and then take a break.